Thank you. I'm very happy to be here. I'll be giving you three talks about things about to do with black holes, stuff we've been playing with over the last few years. I'd like you to stop me and ask questions as we go through. It's more difficult to ask questions at the end when everything is piled up. So whatever is not very clear, please do ask. And if that's not a good time for me to answer the question, I'll just defer it to later and try to come back to it. OK, so this is the things I'll be talking about. As you probably know, there are some puzzles which arise when we look at quantum mechanics and black holes. And roughly speaking, these puzzles can be categorized into two kinds. There's two types of puzzles. One is the entropy puzzle, and one is the information puzzle. They are very closely connected, as we will see. But let us just begin by reviewing these puzzles. It's very important to resolve these puzzles, because when you look at black holes and quantum mechanics, that is where all of physics is getting in at the same place. You have gravity, so Newton's constant G comes into the story. You have quantum mechanics, so H bar comes in. And of course, we have set C equals 1. So in fact, all the fundamental constants of nature are going to go and play a role there. So if you want to understand something deep about how space and time behaves, how it interacts with matter, then the quantum theory of black holes is the right place to go and look for it. And if we can't resolve these puzzles, we have contradictions. If we resolve these contradictions, possibly we'll end up understanding how quantum gravity is supposed to work. The stuff I'll be talking about, more details of that can be found in this review, which I put on the web a few months ago. So I'll often refer for details of the calculations which I'm doing for you to go back and look for further details in this review. And this work which I'll be talking about has been done in various stages with my students and postdocs who are listed over here. OK, so before I go, let me check. Is this completely clear and readable to everybody? And is the voice also carrying all the way to the back? OK, so let's begin with reviewing the entropy puzzle. So here's a black hole. That's just my cartoon of a black hole. That's the horizon. That's the singularity at r equals 0. And now suppose we take a little box containing some gas. The gas has some entropy S. And we take this box and we throw it into the black hole. And the gas disappears all the way into the singularity. And it's gone. And you can't see it anymore. What happens to the second law of thermodynamics? One might think at first that the entropy has decreased. So in fact, if you have a black hole, you can start decreasing the entropy of your universe. And that's, of course, very bad, because the second law tells us that the entropy should never decrease. But of course, that's too hasty. If you throw stuff into a black hole, you might think the entropy of the black hole must go up. That would happen if, for example, you threw the gas into a garbage can. The entropy of the garbage can would go up. This thing is a little bit different, though, because when things go into the garbage can, if you open the can and look in it, you would at least find the gas in there. But of course, if you throw something into a black hole, it seems to just vanish. But anyway, that apart, you might think the entropy has gone into the black hole, so we should measure the entropy of the black hole. And sure enough, the black hole certainly gets bigger when it eats up this little box of gas. And so it turns out, if you do these Gedanken experiments, that if you attribute to the black hole an entropy given by the area upon 4g, in units where C and H bar have been set to 1, then in fact, the second law of thermodynamics works very beautifully. The entropy of the matter plus the entropy of the black hole together becomes a non-decreasing function. And we have saved the second law of thermodynamics. But of course, what we have learned in the process is that the black holes must be attributed an entropy, which is proportional to their horizon area. In fact, with these units up here, the entropy is equal to the area of the horizon measured in units of Planck length squared. So you can already see that if you have a rather large black hole, let's say a solar mass black hole, whose radius is 3 kilometers, the entropy is going to be rather large. That itself so far is not a contradiction with anything. But here comes the first puzzle, the entropy puzzle. If you go to statistical mechanics, the entropy of any system is a logarithm of the number of states. So the entropy of the black hole should be the log of the number of states of the black hole for a given value of conserved quantities like mass, charge, and angular momentum. So you would have to say that the black hole should have e to the power s, S black hole number of states. So if we just apply that to a solar mass black hole, we already said that the entropy was the area of the horizon measured in units of Planck length squared. And so the number you get is something like 10 to the power 10 to the power 77, a very large number of states for a solar mass black hole. Well, where are these states? When people started looking for states around black holes, they found a puzzle. The kind of calculations they did soon got encoded in some kind of a pseudo theorem or a feeling that people got about black holes. Black holes have no hair, which basically means if you try to take the black hole, and suppose you start looking for states of the black hole as small perturbations of the horizon, you might think you could deform the black hole a little bit for the same mass and charge, and maybe if you could find a lot of such states, they might account for the entropy of the black hole. But it turns out that if you make a deformation on the black hole like this, the black hole very soon settles down back to the spherically symmetric one, and there are no such states. So a black hole has no hair, there are no deformations you can see, so whatever energy you put in such a deformation, part of it falls to the singularity, the rest of it flows off to infinity, and in a time scale of the order of the crossing time for light across the black hole radius, all these waves just disperse, and you're left back with this spherically symmetric bald black hole, so you say black holes have no hair. If that were indeed true, if the state of the black hole was fixed by its mass and charges, in that case, of course, you would have to say the entropy is log of one, there's just one state, which would be zero, and that is a contradiction to the fact that you were looking for a very large number of states. So here's the entropy puzzle. Where are all the states of the black hole? So I just write that out more explicitly on the next slide. So here's the puzzle. Where are the states of the black hole? And at this stage, you might start puzzling. You just seen how the black hole was made. You took some stuff, you threw it in, and it shrank in there, went maybe at r equal to zero. Well, so where is all those, could all the states be? Are they at the horizon? Well, the entropy was measured by the horizon area, so you might think they might be at the horizon. But then the nature, if you put any fluctuation near the horizon, you simply can't make different microstates. It just stabilizes, becomes a spherically symmetric horizon. So perhaps they're not at the horizon. Could they be at the singularity, r equal to zero? After all the matter you threw in to make the black hole, it all went into r equal to zero, so maybe the information about exactly which state the black hole is in might be at r equal to zero, but as we'll see shortly, that causes an even bigger problem. In fact, the Hawking information paradox, which will be the next puzzle that we are going to take a look at. Possibly they might be everywhere inside the black hole. Could they be distributed all the way from the horizon inside all the way to r equal to zero? Well, we'll have to see, because at least in the classical picture of the black hole, that part is all completely unique. The whole metric is fixed inside, outside, all the way to r equal to zero by just solving the classical equations of gravity. So it's still a puzzle. It's not clear where all those states are. So even though you must attribute entropy to the black hole, otherwise you can't say the second law of thermodynamics. And it all works very well in Gedanken experiments. The value of the area upon four works very beautifully for everything. But then where are the states? Well, let's move on to the next puzzle then, the information puzzle. So again, as we said, we have an entropy for the black hole. And if you start believing in thermodynamics and applying it also to black holes, you would come across a relation. Change in entropy is a temperature times dE. dS is tdE is basic thermodynamics. And if you just take a Schwarzschild black hole in 3+1 dimensions, then area upon 4g, as you probably know, the radius of a Schwarzschild black hole is, just one second. Your Schwarzschild black hole is 2gm. And so I've just taken the area 4 pi r squared and put 4g. So I get some entropy. The energy is just the mass m, and so you can compute a temperature, dS dm, and you get 8 pi gm. This thing should have a temperature. Yes, there was a question in the back. I'm sorry, thank you. It should be dE is tdS, thank you. Is this equation fine? This should be okay. This one is okay. So you should get a temperature, which is 8 pi gm. So well, at first people would be a little puzzled with this, could say, because something has a temperature, and if it can absorb things, then it must also radiate. Because in statistical mechanics, you have what is called detailed balance. If you can absorb and you have a temperature, then you must radiate, and the radiation rate is given by a formula which comes from the temperature, just the Boltzmann factor, and the absorption coefficient. Since black holes didn't seem to emit anything classically, that might be a little puzzling. But then, as Hawking showed, once you take quantum mechanics into account, black holes do radiate at a temperature T, and this process given in the following way. This is rather a colloquial description. One has to actually go to the more detailed field theory calculation, but for our present purposes, this is all I'll need to say about it. So here's the black hole horizon. You have vacuum fluctuations going on everywhere in space-time, here, outside, inside, everywhere. But then in the region of the horizon, there is a small differential gradient of the gravitational field. Near any body, the field is weaker far away and stronger close by. So if a pair of particles is produced from the vacuum, a particle-antiparticle pair, in a place like this room where there might be no gravitational field, they would simply re-annihilate after a while. But if there is a gravitational field, it's possible that one member flows outwards, and the other one, which is slightly more inside, where the field is a little larger, falls in. And so the particles which go out, they show up as radiation at infinity, and the particles that go in, they cancel off the mass of the black hole, and so the black hole evaporates away. So that's Hawking's process of black hole evaporation, but it leads to the following puzzle. You start with a large cloud of dust, so this is ordinary matter, just a dust cloud, and then under its own self-gravitation, it starts collapsing. All the matter disappears into r equal to zero, and there's a horizon around it. But then at the horizon, by vacuum fluctuations, you start creating these particle-antiparticle pairs, and the antiparticle pairs go in and annihilate the black hole mass. So energy is, of course, conserved, but the particles that go out leave you with all this radiation at the end. So the mass of this dust cloud has gone converted to the mass of this radiation. That itself, of course, is not a contradiction because mass and therefore energy has been conserved. But the puzzle is that this radiation came out of just vacuum fluctuations and therefore was sensitive only to the total mass of the black hole. Because the mass of the black hole creates the geometry, there's nothing else here. The region around the horizon is just empty space. That's a very important fact in this classical geometry and a fact we'll keep coming back to. If this region is empty space, the vacuum fluctuations here have no knowledge of this initial dust cloud except the total mass of that dust cloud. So in fact, when the radiation is all done and created, this radiation has no information of the initial matter apart from, let's say, its total conserved charges, the total mass, perhaps total charge and total angular momentum. But in that case, you cannot possibly start from here and guess what the exact state of this matter was. If you made the black hole in two different ways from two different kinds of matter, the final radiation would still look the same. So what we have lost is the reversibility, which is a very basic part of quantum mechanics. In quantum mechanics, if you have any Hamiltonian for this whole large global process of making and then evaporating a black hole, the final state, psi final, would have to come from some evolution e to the minus iht on psi initial, which of course you can turn around, and psi initial is e to the iht on psi final. So in quantum mechanics, everything is of course reversible. You can look at the final state and say which initial state it came from. But in the case of black hole radiation, you cannot look at the radiation and see exactly which state of the initial matter it came from. And so, in fact, you would say that no quantum mechanical process could possibly describe all of black hole radiation. And in fact, Hawking, who discovered this problem, went so far as to say that we should give up quantum mechanics. We should replace the S matrix of quantum mechanics by a dollar matrix, which only evolves mixed states to mixed states, and pure states are very special. They don't really survive in a general theory which has gravity. Nobody was very happy with that conclusion, I would guess, because quantum mechanics works perfectly well for everything else. So maybe something is wrong with how Hawking radiation was derived. I'll come back to that in a second, but here I just want to stress the importance of the problem. If you actually have Hawking radiation the way we have just seen from this particular derivation of just vacuum fluctuations giving rise to radiation, you will lose basic quantum mechanics. So you cannot reconcile the general theory of relativity, which obviously makes black holes for you, and just the normal quantum theory, which creates this radiation. So just to emphasize again, what really is the thing which has created the problem with the evaporating black hole? You could also take a piece of coal and burn it. After a while, the coal will disappear, and you just have some radiation filling up the room. But in this case, there's no information loss because every photon which leaves this piece of burning coal leaves from the surface of the coal. And as it leaves from the surface, it can actually see the whole atomic structure and whatever state the whole coal might be in. So the radiation which finally fills the room knows in full detail, if you were to study it in sufficient detail and exactly, it would know everything about what was the state of the piece of coal. The reason the same thing didn't happen for the black hole is that the information disappeared into r equal to zero here. the radiation came out from the horizon here, and the gap from here to here is 3 kilometers. So that's the essence of the problem. The matter was here, the radiation came out from here, and this place was empty space. And you could make that distance as big as you want. A solar mass black hole is already 3 kilometers in radius. A black hole like the one in the center of the galaxy is 1 million miles in radius out there. And theoretically, you could make this distance as long as you like. The bigger the black hole you make, the more trouble you seem to be in. So in fact, because the radiation which is coming out cannot see the state of the black hole, cannot see the state of the matter which made the black hole, that is why you actually have this paradox. So in fact, this might set the stage for what we are actually going to see string theory might be trying to tell us. So before I go to that, I just want to emphasize one thing. Several people have pointed out or have tried to argue in various different ways that perhaps the derivation of Hawking, which actually got these particle-antiparticle pairs produced at the horizon, might be wrong for one reason or another. Let me just point out here that I would actually believe that you could take that derivation and convert it into, let's say, quote unquote, a theorem in the following way. So I'm just trying to restate Hawking's argument in a way which makes it look completely rigorous. I wouldn't be presenting you the derivation of this here, but in fact, if anybody wants to chat with me in private later on, we could discuss that, but I wouldn't have time to go into how to derive this right here. But suppose you were to believe two completely reasonable sounding statements. A, all quantum gravity effects are confined within a given length scale, Planck length, string length, whatever you like, but fix a length once for all, and if you talk of lengths much bigger than that, suppose quantum gravity does not go out beyond those length scales. It sounds quite reasonable, and in fact, Hawking just assumed that in the region near the horizon, semi-classical physics is okay, quantum gravity cannot come into the picture. You could have quantum gravity where the curvature is strong near r equal to zero, but that's 3 kilometers away. Planck length is only 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. How can quantum gravity effects be important at all? The curvature at the horizon is of order 3 kilometers. That's the curvature length scale. So Hawking said that can't possibly be relevant. And this is just stating that fact once again. Suppose all quantum gravity effects are confined to a given length scale. You could take Planck length, string length, whatever you like, but fix it once for all. And second, suppose you assume that the vacuum is unique, which also sounds like a very natural statement. In that case, the black hole radiation will necessarily cause information loss. So I just put this down here in a more rigorous form as a theorem because sometimes people have said that if you look at Hawking radiation, it comes out as a radiation of wavelength 3 kilometers from a 3 kilometer black hole when you see it at infinity. But when it starts from vacuum fluctuations, the starting vacuum fluctuations are very, very small. That is indeed true, and people have used that to sometimes argue that perhaps Hawking's derivation is not completely right. If it wasn't completely right, of course, you wouldn't have such a strong paradox. But the reason why Hawking's paradox has stayed there in basically the form it has been all the way for the last 30 years is that the argument actually does not need any of those details. You can actually prove this without using any property of physics beyond the Planck scale or anything like that. It's a completely robust argument, and that's why, in fact, in one way or the other, there hasn't been any easy way to crack this puzzle over the last 30 years. What we'll see, though, is that actually string theory is going to give us some rather bizarre output. We're going to see some competition in string theory. We suggest that actually A is the one which is wrong. So in fact, the effects of quantum gravity are not confined to a given length scale like Planck length, and that might look rather bizarre. But in fact, the consequence of that will be that doesn't matter how big a black hole you take, the stuff which you try to shove into the center, r equal to zero, doesn't want to stay there. It in fact will expand in one way or the other and actually fill up the entire interior of the black hole. This is what we want to come to towards the end, but right now we just give a preview of where we want to reach. It might look rather bizarre right now because, as we just said, it's quite logical for quantum gravity effects to stay confined within the Planck length. So let me just say a little bit about that on the next slide. But while we have this picture here, let me just mention, this is what we had on the last slide. The trouble we had with the information paradox was the radiation leaving from here could not see the state of the matter. If the information about the state of the matter is distributed throughout the ball, of course you no longer have that problem, and the black hole would behave just like a piece of coal, like any other object in quantum theory. Radiation leaves from here, carries out the information, and the black hole disappears. So in fact, if we do come to a conclusion like this, just one second, if we do come to a conclusion like this, and the entire black hole is full of information all the way to the horizon, of course it would take the puzzle away. Yes, there was a question there. There are several ways to define the vacuum. Yes, no, this was a much simpler statement than that. If you just take a finite small region, let's say the region of the size of this room, the curvature length scale could be, let's say, 100 million kilometers. Just take a region of a bounded volume, let's say 100 meters by 100 meters. In that case, there is a unique state, which let's say has the lowest possible energy, and you don't have, in that bounded volume, an infinite number of states in energy epsilon, where epsilon goes to zero. There should not be an unbounded number of states in an arbitrarily small energy gap. If you had lots and lots of states, in fact, an infinite number of states below any energy epsilon, I would say then the vacuum is not unique in a bounded volume. Suppose that happened, and that would be awful. We can argue about that, but if you have that, physics loses all predictability because you wouldn't know in this vacuum if you throw a ball from here to there, you don't know the ball will travel like this or just get deflected because you don't know if it was in this vacuum or the vacuum which had almost the same energy and was like this. So you lose all predictability. So that's what I meant by saying that the vacuum is unique in a bounded volume where in fact curvature is irrelevant for the moment. There should be just one state or at least a finite number of states below some given energy. Okay, so that almost ends my introduction to the problem, but I just want to put up this last slide to show how can such a bizarre thing happen. What I'm really trying to say here, in quantum gravity, of course, let's go back to our basic fundamental constants of nature. There is C, there's H bar, there's G, and out of those, if you just put all the units together to make something with units of length, as you very well know from your undergraduate education, you get Planck length, LP, and Planck length in 3+1 dimensions in our world here might be something like 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. It's a very small length in there. So, and of course, if you do any kind of high energy collision, if you take two gravitons and you collide them at very high energy, you might expect the only time you start seeing effects of quantum gravity is when this energy scale becomes of the order of Planck length. There's only one length scale in the problem, and that's basically right. If you had string theory, you might see the effect of string length, but string length, Planck length just differ by a fixed constant, the dilaton, and we'll assume that's order unity. So in fact, if you do collide just two particles, it's true that quantum gravity effects or string effects start only when the energies become string scale, or if you like, the lengths become string length or shorter, Planck length or shorter. But when you want to make a black hole, it's a little bit different. To make a large black hole, you need to use a large number of quanta. The number of quanta n is much, much bigger than one. The bigger the black hole you need to make, the more quanta n you'll have to put together. And now you have to re-ask the question, if you have a large number n of quanta, is the length scale of quantum gravity, the length scale over which space-time breaks down, the length scale over which everything is non-local, the length scale over which nothing makes sense in terms of classical physics, is that still something like L Planck, or could it perhaps be a power n to the alpha times L Planck? This is at least worth thinking, and if there was something which goes like a power n to the alpha, of course then the range of quantum gravity would start increasing as you put more and more quanta together, in particular as you try to make bigger and bigger black holes. In fact, from the few calculations we'll be showing you here with simple black hole type systems, this power alpha turns out to be such that this length n to the, that alpha is not zero, alpha is positive. The scale of these objects seems to grow with alpha, like some n to the alpha times L Planck. And in fact, it turns out to just grow in such a way that the length scale you reach is the same length scale as the horizon would have. So in fact, we'll take simple systems, what are called two-charge extremal black holes in string theory. We'll actually construct all of their microstates, and we'll see that the microstates are not point-like or string size or Planck size, as you might at first think. The size of those states actually grows with the number of quanta that you have tried to bind together. So if you bind, let's say, more quanta, thing just becomes bigger. It becomes bigger in such a way that, in fact, all the other parameters in the story cancel out, like G and the volumes of compact dimension all disappear, and they leave you with a size in each case, which is of the order of the radius of the horizon. So there is something to do with the horizon does come back into the story, but we don't get like an empty ball with a singularity at r equal to zero. We seem to get something different. So what I'm gonna do is, in this set of lectures, I'll try to show you the details of how these states are made. After we make these states, we can talk about what this might mean for black holes. I'll also show you towards the end how some states of three-charge black holes can be made. We have not been able to make states of all three-charge black holes, but I would normally believe that if you can also show this to work for the generic three-charge black hole state, it would then have to work for all kinds of black holes. There was a question back there. No, it depends on, okay, I have not been very precise on what n is. As you will see in string theory, when you want to make a black hole, you have to mix many different kinds of brains. So for example, the Strominger and Wafers classic black hole, which was so important for black hole theory, has D1 brains, D5 brains, and momentum charges. There are three different kinds of charges. So this n is some kind of a product of all those charges. So right now I'm being very rough. You'll see the details as we go on. And also, how the radius changes with the mass depends on how many dimensions you are in, right? It's only in four dimensions that n is proportional to m is proportional to r. Yes. No, it's very, no, that's a good question. What ends up happening is that black holes in four dimensions have also been worked on. The kind of black hole people work on are extremal black holes, but you can also extrapolate to non-extremal black holes like the Schwarzschild black hole. It turns out when you look at all these formulae for when you extrapolate to non-extremal black holes or just look at the extremal black holes, if you put some mass m into making a black hole, it doesn't just make one kind of an object in there. String theory has so many different objects. Does it all go into gravitons? Does it all go into some kind of deep brain? It turns out you actually get the entropy of the black hole right if you take the mass and you partition it among lots of different kinds of brains and antibrains. And not just one kind again. You might make D1, D1 bar, D5, D5 bar, and you put all of them together, only then can you understand the entropy of the black holes, even in four dimensions. So after we see how black holes are made in string theory, which is the next thing I'm going to do, you'll see that, in fact, it's a mixing of different kinds of brains which actually creates entropy in string theory. And it's the same kind of mixing of brains. Whenever you get entropy, it's only at that time you also start getting size. Thing puffs up. So the meaning of this alpha, it'll vary from dimension to dimension. Of course, if all this has to make any sense, it should work in all dimensions, all kinds of black holes, should be duality covariant, everything. Yes. Yeah, no, that's a good question. And again, that's something I would like to talk about later after we have the picture of the black holes microstates up on the board. Let me just make one casual comment about that before moving on. Anytime you have a complex statistical system, you can observe it on different time scales. Associated to a black hole, there are two time scales. One is a very short time scale, which is the crossing time across the black hole, which is a fraction of a second for a 3 kilometer black hole. Then there's a very long time scale, which is the Hawking evaporation time scale, which for a black hole of solar mass is 10 to the power 120 years. Okay. So that's huge. The universe is only 10 to the 11 years old. Okay. So in fact, because there are two time scales, there are processes acting on these two different time scales. And over the short time scale of just the crossing time, it's completely possible that you actually can't pick up the differences between microstates. It's possible that you can represent whatever short time physics this mess is going to produce by something that behaves like this. We'll see that for a short time when something goes into this mess, it just gets absorbed in there because it just keeps going round and round. And a way to model that is to just say there's a horizon, you fall in, you can never come out. Now, if you want to wait for a longer time, from here we'll see things do come out, and that's over the Hawking evaporation time. And over those long time scales, this is not a good picture. So when we see the states on the board, we'll try to answer that a little better. Okay, so that was my brief intro to the puzzle about what black holes are. What I now want to do is talk about some stuff which was done with black holes in 96, arriving at the celebrated result of Strominger and Wafer about the entropy of black holes. So I just want to introduce to you the way that black hole is made and to talk a few things about it. So what I'm going to do here is just try to arrive at what's called a three-charge Strominger-Wafer black hole. After I'll go back and talk for a long time about the two-charge system, which is simpler than the three-charge system. Historically, playing with the string theory in black holes, Susskind threw out a few ideas about how one might make black holes in string theory. Then Ashok Sen and figured out how to understand a two-charge system, which gave the entropy correct up to a factor of order unity. Recently, in fact, the factor of order unity has also been fixed. I'll come back and talk about it later. But if you make a three-charge black hole, it's easy to actually nail the entropy down in string theory, down to the last factor of 2 and pi. So I'll first go all the way to the three-charge, understand that, and then just backstep one step to two-charge. So, okay, black holes in string theory. How are you going to make a black hole? So it's very nice that we have a full theory of quantum gravity, string theory, where all the interactions are in principle completely fixed. String theory has no free parameters. You just know all the interactions, objects in the theory, what brains you can have, are all completely determined. So all you have to do is to make a black hole out of strings and just see what it looks like. Does it look like having a horizon and a point like saying like r equal to zero, or does it look like all the objects just puff up? Not just a technical question within string theory, but first we must know how to make black holes in string theory. Okay, so to make the black hole, of course we have to use only the objects which you have in the string theory, and then what do you want to do with them? You want to take a large collection of brains or whatever you have and concentrate a large amount of mass at a point and see if it will make a black hole for you. Okay, so let's just to be particular, let's take 2A string theory, and we have this 10-dimensional space, Minkowski space with 9 space and 1 time dimension. And as you can see, I'll start taking the basic object in the theory. The simplest object is the NS1 brain, or the elementary string if you like. If I just leave the string by itself, it'll just collapse to a point like mass zero graviton, which will then just run away. So in fact, I would like to wrap the string on something perhaps. So I'd like one circle available to me. So let me just take the M9, 1 and compactify one circle, and then the non-compact directions are M8, 1. And then in that direction, I can wrap the string, and I want to take N1 of them, not just one of them, because I want to take a large number. I'll put them together, and that'll make a big black hole. I'll take N1 large at the end. But it's very important for me now to concentrate on the fact that I don't want to take separate string loops like this. I want to deal with a bound state. The issue of bound state will be actually a very critical feature throughout all these lectures. What's the issue for bound state? If I just had separate little loops like this, they would correspond to, in the direction which where you don't resolve the compact direction, if you just look at the non-compact direction, every string wrapped in the compact direction looks like a little blob of mass, let's say. But these are different blobs of mass, and what you have made, even if these were like black holes, you made lots of different little black holes. But that's not what we are looking for. We want to make one black hole. For to make one black hole, we must make the bound states of these objects. We want one black hole, not lots of different black holes. That's important, of course, because the entropy, which is what we're going to try to get to here, is the entropy of one hole. And as you know, if you take the mass and break it up into lots of little holes, that's not the same entropy at all. So if you want to make a bound state of lots of little strings, well, it's pictorially very easy. You simply take the string, it goes around the loop, and then goes around the loop again and again. And after it has done N1 turns, then you seal it back onto itself. So you get what you'd call a long string with winding number N1, and you wrap it there and just sits there. And for an observer who cannot see the compact direction, it just looks like a little blob which has some mass, but because it also carries winding charge, it's a BPS object with mass equal to this winding charge. Let's see if we have managed to make a black hole, or if this has not been good enough for our purpose. Just 1 second, let me put this down. Yes. What are the Navier-Schwarz one brains? Just a fancy word for the elementary string. Just a fundamental string. Okay. I used to call it F for fundamental string, but I saw that everybody got confused with F, so I started switching to NS1. Okay, so, yeah. Okay, so here I'm going to write you the metric for the string. And, you know, when you see a lot of these metrics, you might just feel sleepy and see that you don't want to see them. And you don't actually have to see them in any great detail, except I just want to show you the general features of those metrics, and because those features are going to take us towards where we want to go, so I'll tell you what you should concentrate on in these formulae. So we'll write the metric in the string frame, though you must remember when you finally want to compute the area of the horizon and divide by 4g to get the entropy, you have to do it in the Einstein frame, but it's just easier to write the metrics in the string frame, so I've just done that. So here's the metric in the string frame, just produced by that NS1, the fundamental string, wrapped on a circle. So as you can imagine, this is the time direction. Y is the direction of that S1 where we had wrapped the string. And these are all the 8 transverse space directions. You can see the harmonic function H1 keeps coming all over the place. And the harmonic function goes like, it goes to 1 at infinity. So in fact, this is flat space at infinity. You can see that. Dilton also goes to constant at infinity. But then as you come closer in, it goes like 1 over r to the 6. That's just the normal kind of the law, which would have been a 1 by r potential in 3+1 dimensions. It's 1 over r to the 6 because you have a one-dimensional object, which is effectively a point-like object in 8+1 dimension. So just like harmonic functions, and they show up here in the string frame. Okay, so now if you want to compute the entropy of this, of whatever you have made from this metric, the Bekenstein entropy by measuring some area, now you might wonder, area of what should you measure when there are some compact dimensions in there? Is it only the non-compact dimensions whose area you should try to measure, or should you measure the area in the full compact dimensions? If you include the compact direction, everything looks like some kind of a cylinder, so this would be the horizon in the non-compact directions, and if you were able to resolve the compact directions, you would see it looks like a cylinder. Suppose that length of that compact direction is L. Should you measure the total area of this thing, or only this kind of an area in the non-compact directions? Well, the answer is you could do whichever one you wanted. You could take either the area in this 8 plus 1 non-compact space, but then you must divide by the Newton constant of that 8 plus 1 dimension space, or you could take the area including this compact direction, A10, and then divide by G10, and they come out to be the same thing, because the area of the 10 dimension thing has an extra L in it, but also when you compute Newton's constant of 9 dimensions, you take Newton's constant of 10 dimension and divide by L. So it all ultimately cancels out. You can work either in the non-compact dimensions after dimensional reduction, or you can use all those 10 dimensions. You can also lift because type 2A theory, you could think of it in 11 dimensions. You could add in that extra circle X11, then everything would be also a cylinder in the 11th direction. You could make the area A11, but then you must divide by G11. And these all turn out to be equal. It's a very simple point, but I just wanted to make it, because otherwise it could be a little confusing. What do we mean by area? But you do either of these and you work it out for this metric, you find the area of the horizon is zero, so you get no Bekenstein entropy from this. Let us see why the entropy came out to be zero. If we can understand why it became zero, then maybe we can figure out how to make it something other than zero and get something more interesting. But before we do that, we can already see that at least this time we don't have a contradiction. Because if you go and see how many microstates you expected for the system, all you had was a string which is wrapped on a circle many times, just sitting there doing nothing. And if you see how many states there are for a string which is just wrapped up here, and just not vibrating or doing anything else, well, there's just one state for it. So in fact, the microscopic count of states would give you log 1 equals 0. It's not exactly 1, it's actually 256, because you know a string always, because of fermion 0 mode, has a multiplet. The string you can T-dualize, you'll get a graviton. But along with the graviton, there's the graviton, the dilaton, the B field, that 256 dimensional massless multiplet which dualizes to the string. But in any case, the log of a fixed number is a number which doesn't grow with N1. There's no classical large number. It doesn't grow with the number of charges. It doesn't become bigger. So from the classical limit, you just have to call the 0. It does not grow with N1. So at least string theory knows what it is doing. It did not produce for you that funny kind of entropy puzzle which we saw when just working with normal gravity. Now S Bekenstein has come out to be zero because the metric had no area, but also S microscopic is also zero. So we got 0 equals 0, which may not be very exciting, but it's much better than having a contradiction. Okay, so now let's go back and ask, why was the area actually zero? If we can fix that problem, then maybe we can make black holes where the area of the horizon is not zero. And for that, it's good to go back and look at it in the whole 11-dimensional language. Let's do that. So in 11D, we had this X11. And this was the S1, the Y direction on which we had wrapped the 2A string. So I have two compact directions, and the fundamental string of 2A was just an M2 brain, which was of course wrapped on X11, but now we have also wrapped the string on this S1, which was the Y direction. So in fact, it's an M2 brain, which is wrapped on a T2. Well, it's a general property of D brains in any string theory or N theory. If you wrap a brain on some cycles of a torus, just by its own tension, the brain tries to shrink those cycles. So that makes sense. If you have a cycle like this, you wrap a brain there, it's just trying to pinch the cycle. So in fact, this brain will try to pinch X11. It'll try to pinch Y as well. If it pinches the X11 down to zero size, well, that tells the dilaton should go to minus infinity. And if you look back at the previous slide and you saw what happened to dilaton, the dilaton in fact was going to minus infinity. So that the pinching in the X11 direction kills the dilaton. And if you look in the Y direction, the circle is also getting pinched. And anyway, for both of these reasons, you can see very easily, let's work in the 11D language. The area of the 11D horizon comes out to be zero. The Newton's constant 11D is just fixed. There's nothing like string or frame or Einstein frame in 11D. So it's easier to use 11D language for this. And so because the area of the horizon has become zero, the whole thing just got pinched by the tension of the brain. The S Bekenstein went to zero. But brains do something else which is interesting. They cause the directions along their world volume to shrink because of their own tension. But they cause the directions perpendicular to them to expand. And they do that because brains radiate field. They are charged brains, they radiate field, and field has energy. And the lines of flux of a field don't want to crowd together. They want to get as far away from each other as possible. So directions perpendicular to the brain try to expand. Well, that tells us how we might try to fix this problem. If we actually use a brain which is wrapping along X11, if you could take another brain, which let's say is perpendicular to X11 and put them both together, then, for example, as far as the X11 circle is concerned, one brain will be trying to shrink it, the other brain will be trying to expand it, and then the whole thing will balance out. And that way we could make a black hole which has a nice finite horizon area, and that's exactly what we will do. So you can see from here why we need to use more than one kind of a brain to get to a good black hole. And so to prevent X11 from shrinking, what you could do is go back to this M theory, and of course you have M5 brains also. And I can take M5 brains and I can put them perpendicular to the X11 direction. I had a picture somewhere, here's X11. This was the NS1 brain which also wraps the X11. But the 5 brain can be put transverse to X11. And if you put a 5 brain transverse to X11, it also becomes an NS5 brain in type 2A theory. So that's the brain I'm taking now. So now I have NS5 brains in type 2A. That's gonna come back and help me. But if I have NS5 brains, I need 5 directions to wrap them up to make a compact object. So if I'm going to compactify some more directions, my M9,1, the transverse part, non-compact part, I'll leave as 4,1. I already had an S1 which was compact. I'll take another T4 to help me. My NS1 brains were already wrapped along the S1, and my NS5 brains will wrap the T4 and the S1. So this is completely clear. I now have 2 kinds of brains with me. I have NS1 and I have NS5. And the NS5 are wrapping in the 2A language all these directions. You can see what's doing in M theory there if you like. But the S1 brains are wrapping, the NS1s are wrapping only the S1. And now you can write the metric for all of this. Now you get 2 harmonic functions, one coming from the NS1 brains, one coming from the NS5. Because now we have only 4 + 1 non-compact directions, the harmonic functions are like 1/r² instead of 1/r². But otherwise, basically the same game, you get harmonic functions. If you look at a dilaton, H5/H1, at small r, this guy and this guy both go like 1/r². The ratio goes to a finite constant. So you can see dilaton has been stabilized, which is like saying the X11 circle, the length of that has become stabilized. But that's exactly what we had imagined. As far as X11 is concerned, the fundamental string squeezes it, the 5 brain expands it, and you can see the whole thing has balanced out. If you look at the other directions which are compact now, the T4 direction and the S1, here I've drawn a cartoon of T4 and S1. I'm drawing the T4 and the S1 over here. So the 5 brains wrap all of this, and the 1 brains wrap only the S1. As far as the T4 directions are concerned, they are this way. You can see they nicely balance out because the 1 brain is perpendicular to them and the 5 brain is along them. The NS5 shrinks it and the NS1 expands it. So the T4 will be nice and stable. It's only the S1 which should have a problem because the S1 is shrinking because of the NS1. The S1 is also shrinking because of the NS5. Looking at this out here, you might think it's not quite like the S1 direction is Y. And if you look at H1 inverse, you can see the H1 inverse brings an R² upstairs, that small r. So you can see it is shrinking, it's going to 0. I said the NS5 is also shrinking it, but you don't see the H5 here. But that's all because I'm using the string frame. If you just went to the Einstein frame, it looked very symmetrical. This would become H1 to the minus a half, H5 to the minus a half. So once you go to the Einstein frame, you really see what I'm talking about in words here, that every brain tries to shrink along its length, expand perpendicular to its length. That's not so clear in the string metric, but we just use a string metric because it's easy to write these functions down. So anyway, now the T4 is nice and stable, both push and pull. X11 is nice and stable, you're both pushing and pulling. All we need to do is to fix up this problem with the Y circle, and then we'll be all set. So what should we add along the Y direction? We could take the momentum and add it along Y. Just put some momentum in that direction. Why would that help? Because if you have momentum going along the Y direction, if you have NP units of momentum, you know the energy of a momentum mode is 1/r. So the energy would be NP over the length of the Y direction, radius of the Y direction. And so the radius, if you have put some momentum there, you would minimize the energy if R became bigger. So momentum modes act opposite to how tensions of brains work. So in fact, now we can just complete our picture of what we want to do. Our M9,1 is compactified to the non-compact part M4,1. Our T4 and S1 are compact. NS1 brains wrapped here. NS5 brains wrapped from this and this. And the momentum running along the S1. And now you can write the metric for all of them. We already had the H1 and the H5 showing up on the board before. And now we have this K showing up, which is another harmonic function. And K tells you how much of the momentum charge there was. You can see what's happening to the Y circle now. The Y circle, H1 comes as an inverse, it's shrinking. K comes as it is, the R is at the bottom, it's expanding, and the Y circle is stabilized. So in fact, you can read off the fact that all the things become stable. Dilaton V has already stabilized, and this actually will make us a nice black hole. But now we have picked up 3 charges, NS1, NS5, and P. And as we'll see shortly by doing an S-duality, it becomes the standard frame in which Stromae and Wafa had first talked about this, the D1, D5P black hole. But this is why we can see why to make a black hole in string theory, you need to take many different kinds of brains and mix them together. Just one kind of brain doesn't actually make a good black hole, but that's all nice and consistent because one kind of brain, there's no microscopic entropy either. So somehow string theory seems to know what it is doing. And with three charges, we managed to make a nice stable black hole. Let's play a little bit with the properties of this black hole. Yes. You could have done that. I just started with NS5 because I also wanted to stabilize the dilaton. Okay, but NS1 and NS5 together. Okay, so the NS5 acts to expand the S1 direction. Okay. If I just took NS1 and P, the dilaton would still go to minus infinity at the brain. Okay, I'm trying to fix all of those issues. Yeah. But in fact, ultimately, we will come back to the NS1P case. That's the two-charge system. And talk about that, because we'll see that even though dilaton is in trouble, we'll still get a horizon out of that. So in fact, that was the initial Ashok Sen black hole. It only had NS1 and P. And in fact, now we understand that many of the important properties of black holes were already contained in NS1 and P. If I expand all of them to classical sizes, I can just get a very classical black hole whose entropy I'm just going to derive. So this was just an introduction to Stromae and Wafa. But yes, we'll come back and then work with just the two-charge system for most of this lecture and the next. Okay, so near r equal to 0, if you want to see what we managed to do, near r equal to 0, did we manage to make a horizon? The transfer space was this dxi, dxi. It was 4 plus 1 non-compact dimensions. We'll leave the time out of it. There are four space directions. And if you look at the metric in those four space non-compact directions, it was basically a flat metric with this h5 multiplying it. h5 was a harmonic function, 1 plus q5 over r square. So I'm going to take that and write this dxi, dxi, this flat space in polar coordinates, dr square plus r square d omega 3 square. And if you go to small r, I'll forget this one, it's a q5 over r square, and all I want you to see is, well, this part becomes a dr square over r square, but the d omega 3 square, it has no prefactor anymore. The r square is multiplied, the d omega 3 square has gotten exactly canceled by this r square. And so I can now see that at least as far as the non-compact transverse sphere is concerned, the 3 sphere which encloses the place r equal to 0, where I tried to put all these brains, the area of that sphere has become nice and non-zero. The area of a 3 sphere of unit size is 2 pi square. So because the radius is q5 to the half, I just put the q5 to the 3 half, and that's the area of the S3. As we said, if you want to compute the total entropy of the whole thing, let's say, suppose you want to do it in 10 dimensions, then I should compute the area in 10 dimensions. So I have not only this S3 direction, I also have the S1 direction length, which I have to worry about. There's a length in the Y direction, the S1. In the string frame, it came out to be this if you just look at the metric. And again, the important thing was one harmonic function on top, another harmonic function on the bottom. The R squares canceled, so it went to a constant fixed ratio of numbers. The torus also stabilized, it had some volume. If I multiply them all together, I should compute the area, but not in the string frame. All this metric was in the string frame. I should convert to the Einstein frame. For that, you have to multiply the ratio of Einstein to string metrics, which brings in a dilaton. In any case, when you do all that, you find something which involves all these charges, Q1, Q5, QP, the volume of the torus, the length of the circle, everything comes into the story, and you get something for the area of the black hole horizon in 10 dimensions. If you want to see details of these calculations with all these numbers exactly put in, they're all done explicitly in that review I mentioned to you at the start, and so I'm not actually doing all the numbers and 2 pi's here on the board, since you can go there and look it up. So what are we going to do with this? Now that we have this area, we just want to see what entropy it gives us. But to do that, we have to see what are these numbers, capital Q1, Q5, and QP. They came in as harmonic functions in the metric. So the metric had functions like 1 plus Q1 over R square. So Q1 is obviously proportional to the number of NS1 brains, Q5 proportional to NS5 brains, QP to the number of units of momentum charge. And these are the prefactors which come in. We also have to find the full area and divide by G10. And G10 in string theory, the 10 dimensional Newton's constant, is given in terms of G squared alpha prime. You put all that in and you compute A over 4G, and the thing cleans out dramatically. The entropy comes out to be 2 pi square root of these three numbers, N1, N5, and NP. At this stage itself, this is rather pretty, because a lot of numbers have canceled out. Look at all the mess we had there to start with. For example, we had a string coupling G, we had a length scale alpha prime, we had a volume of the torus V, the length of the S1 circle at infinity, the one in torus at infinity, all these were parameters in the system, they were moduli. Because you can make a black hole starting with any size of S1 and wrapping a string on it. But in fact, in the entropy, all those things nicely cancel out, and you're only left with pure numbers. Now, this fact is very important, because the black hole we have made, all the objects we had mass equal to charge, and the way we put them together, in fact, these objects are mutually BPS, so the final thing we have managed to make is a BPS extremal black hole. Because these are BPS objects, in fact, you can take their states, and you can follow the BPS states through different values of the coupling. So as you change these moduli, like change the coupling G, or change the radius R, or the volume V of the torus, you can't get or lose any states. So in fact, the number of states, which is counted by the entropy, should not have changed as a function of the modulus. If we had done all this calculation, which is just a calculation in classical string theory, and we had been left with some moduli hanging out here in the final answer, we would already be in deep trouble, because no amount of microscopic physics from the string side could ever have explained black hole entropy. Because anything you do with the microstates and actually count states in string theory, you get some number, but then because they are BPS states, as you change G, V, R, the number of states won't change. So we'll get the same answer, which will have no moduli in it. So it's very nice that the answer which we already got from the classical string side, which we'll try to match with the microscopic side, all this mess already canceled out. So in fact, this is actually a hallmark of a lot of things which you will see happening in string theory with black holes. Whenever you start with the gravity side and you come up with some quantity, and this will happen more than once to us, whenever you come up with a quantity in which all these extra moduli like G, V, R, and so on just cancel out and leave you with something which are nice pure numbers, in all those cases you find that there's a nice explanation of all this on the string side, and you can see a direct glimpse of the microstructure of whatever states you're looking at, all the way on the gravity side on the one hand, and on the CFT side on the other. So in fact, this kind of miracle where all this mess cancels out, we'll see it more than once, but this is the first place that we see it, and this is a pretty fact. Just want to draw your attention to it. Okay, so now we have seen how you can make a good black hole in string theory. We have measured the area of the black hole. We have therefore computed its normal Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. And now we want to go and study something about its microstructure. Before we do that, I will talk a little bit about dualities. So let me see how I'm doing for time. When did I start? Pardon? Okay, so I spent about 55 minutes. Okay, thank you. Okay, so let's come to talk a little bit about dualities. So this is what we have been doing here. We had this M9,1, we had two-way string theory, we broke it to M4,1, a T4, S1. The coordinate on S1 was just called Y. I'm just calling it X5 here. The torus coordinates, we didn't give them names, but let's call them X6, 7, 8, 9. And the non-compact ones, let's call them time X0, and then 1, 2, 3, 4. NS1 prints here, NS5 prints here. Momentum along this direction. As we said before, you can convert it to D1, D5P by S duality. But of course, right now we are in 2A, which doesn't have S duality. But you can do a T duality in the direction number 6 of the torus. You can see it changes nothing. NS1 brain, perpendicular to it, if you do a duality, it goes back to NS1. NS5 brain, you do a T duality along it, it does nothing, you get NS5, and the P just goes to the P, so nothing happens. But once you're in 2B, you can do S duality, it'll take you to D1, D5B. But what's even more interesting is that, in fact, you can permute these three charges among each other, the 6 possible permutations. All those permutations are allowed by using S and T dualities. So in particular, if you had in two of the charges, let's say D1 and D5, you could permute them by dualities into any other chain. You could, for example, make them P and NS1. This is going to be important to us, actually critically important for everything we are going to do. So let's just do this little bit of duality chasing to have some fun with it. Duality chasing is always simple, so it's just fun. You start with D1, D5, and type 2B. You do an S duality, brings you to NS1, NS5, still in type 2B. Let's do a T duality along this S1. That's the X5 direction, the Y direction. So the NS1 will become momentum, and the NS5 remains NS5. But now we are in 2A. I want to get back to 2B, so I'll do one of these empty T duality, just the T6, which changes nothing, gives me P NS5 again. I just go back to 2B. I'll do an S duality, bring myself back to 2B, but now it is P and D5. The P goes to P, but NS5 becomes D5. I can do T dualities in the torus, 6, 7, 8, 9, and the D5, I can just collapse it down to a D1, so I'm down to P and D1. I can leave it here, the physics is the same, but just for convenience, I'll do an S duality and make it a P and NS1. And the reason I managed to bring the D1, D5 all the way down to P and NS1 is that this is rather interesting. NS1 is just the fundamental string, as we saw, and P is just momentum. And the fundamental string will be in the S1 direction, and the momentum will also be in the S1 direction. So at this point, all I have is a string which is carrying vibrations, the initial system that Ashok Sen was looking at anyway. So just a string carrying vibrations, an elementary string, which you can go back and learn from your chapter 1 of Green, Schwartz, and Witten, actually holds the information about all the states of D1 and D5. So in fact, these dualities are very important. We'll actually study everything here, because the elementary string will give us some extra power. We know tools there which we don't directly know for D1, D5. And then we'll dualize all the way back, and we'll learn something about D1, D5. If you've already learned something here, why do you want to go there? Because for D1, D5, we actually have, there are two reasons. Firstly, for D1, D5, there's an ADS-CFT dual. D1, D5 has a dual, which is ADS-3, cross S3, cross D4. And so we can bring all of our knowledge of duality once we go back there. And the other advantage we'll have is, once we have D1 and D5, we can then add the third charge P in rather an easy way, and we'll get D1, D5, P. We'll try to go to the three charge black hole. If I try to do that here, I have P and NS1, the third charge would be NS5. It's rather harder to add NS5, but there is an easy way to add P, so we'll make states of D1, D5, P by starting with states of D1, D5. So in fact, we'll play this duality game many times, but as you'll see from this next slide onwards, I'll keep playing with P and NS1, the two charge system for most of the rest of this talk and a large part of the next talk. And after we learned everything about this, we'll keep converting to D1, D5 whenever we want. We'll thoroughly understand the two charge system, and then we'll go on to whatever is known so far about the three charge system. Okay, so that was dualities. Now let's go and see how we get entropy in string theory. So that was, so far we made black holes on the gravity side. We put these brains together, we found the metric they produced, we measured the area, did area over 4G, we got some answer. Now what are we supposed to go and look on the microscopic side? Well, let's first start with one kind of charge, NS1 charge. As you know, if you have only one kind of charge, you can dualize it to anything else. NS1, you can dualize to D1 or just P. Any brain is equal to any brain. So anyway, if you just had NS1 brains, so all the one charge systems you can just see by looking at the NS1 brain, the fundamental string, because you want a bound state, you wrap it N1 times around the circle. Let the circle have a length L on which you are wrapping it. But because one string which you wrap N1 times before sealing it back onto itself, the whole string has a total length, which is N1 times L. We just call it one long string. This fact is going to be very important. LT is the length total. The T just stands for total. The total length of that string is N1 times L, and that's all you have. And as we said before, there's just one state like that, or let's say a 256 dimensional multiplet. We don't care about a small number like 256. It doesn't grow with N anyway. And so the macroscopic entropy we'll just write is log 256, which is like log 1, which is just 0. Well, when you've got two charges, things become more interesting. And this basically is the calculation which Ashok Sen did in late 1994. So now you have NS1 and P. So now you have, we'll just take two charges to be NS1 and P, just so we could dualize to anything we wanted anyway. So let's take NS1 and P. Here's our compact circle. Here's a string wrapped on that circle, and you want momentum going up on that circle. Well, first let's see what happens if we just look at strings and momentum. What is this funny object called momentum? Strings, if you didn't glue them onto each other, were just like little loops wrapped on that circle. And momentum modes by themselves would simply come from the massless modes of string theory racing along at the speed of light along that circle. Could be a graviton, a dilaton, a B field, a massless mode of anything, but racing at the speed of light around that circle, that's also a BPS state. It has mass equal to winding charge, if you like, from the dimensionally reduced point of view. So those are massless modes. But in fact, this is an unbound state, and we have been very particular to say that the only thing which really represents a black hole is the bound state of these objects. What happens when you bind all these NS1s to each other, we already talked about, it just makes one long string. But what happens when you finally glue these massless momentum modes onto that string? Well, it's very simple. How does the string actually glue onto momentum? The string just picks up traveling waves, which move along the string. The string vibrates, it carries the waves along itself, and there the momentum is bound to the string. So in fact, this will be very critical for us. The bound states of winding and momentum are just traveling waves added on to the string. Let's just draw that pictorially a little bit more clearly. So here the string wrapped up on the circle of length L, as we said, and it opened up to the covering space. Okay, that's not the real space. You can just open up to the N1 fold cover, so then it has the whole big length L total equal to N1 times L, and then the string is vibrating there in some fashion, carrying momentum, it's carrying traveling waves. That arrow just says the momentum is going up rather than down. So traveling wave carries momentum, P, up the string. Well, here comes the important point. For a given amount of momentum that you want to put on the string, the momentum is partitioned among the different Fourier modes in many ways. You can put all the momentum, let's say, in the lowest harmonic and have a lot of quanta of the lowest harmonic, or you can put some in the first harmonic, some in the second harmonic. You can put some in the first harmonic, some in second, some in the fifth. There are many ways to partition the total amount of momentum among the different harmonics, and they'll all carry the same total amount of momentum. All the states, of course, have the same amount of winding charge because they all have N1 units of winding charge from the string. So in fact, we already see that for a given amount of charges, winding and momentum, suddenly we have found there are lots of states all having the same energy. We are seeing the appearance of entropy. So how do we partition the momentum among different Fourier modes? If you have one quantum in the Fourier mode K, in the kth harmonic, how much momentum does that carry? It's just moving at the speed of light along a string. Its energy is equal to the momentum, just a massless mode of vibration traveling up a string at the speed of light. Energy of the kth harmonic equal to the momentum of the harmonic, plus 2 pi k upon Lt. So we just have all the modes run on this long string of length Lt, because of course the modes don't have to close back after length L. They're running on a string of length Lt. That's going to be very important for us. But then, so the kth harmonic there would have energy 2 pi k over Lt. How much total momentum do we want to put on the string? If the length of the string is L, if we had said we had NP units of momentum when we were working for the classical black hole, what did we mean by that? The total momentum we are putting on that black hole was 2 pi NP over L. But as we have seen, we should try to write everything in terms of this length Lt, the total length. We could do that. I can put N1 up there and also N1 down here. So the momentum is equal to 2 pi N1 NP upon this total length. Okay, so I have N1 NP units of momentum, of N1 NP units of excitation. Each quanta carries just k units if it's in the kth harmonic. And so all I need to do is to make sure that if for the kith harmonic, for harmonic, let's say ki, if I take mi units of momentum, that accounts for mi ki units out of the total. If I add up mi ki over I, all the different harmonics, I should get N1 NP. All the different ways to do this, in fact, are the total number of states you could get out of a string which is carrying momentum. So if you have charges N1 and NP, if you compute what are called partitions, this is a given number given to us from our charges, all the different ways to partition it among different integers is going to give us the number of states that we have for the system. Well, how to partition an integer like N1 NP in different ways, how to count it up, how much of the like first harmonic, second harmonic, first, second, fifth, all the different ways to distribute things among different harmonics. Well, there's an easy way to count that. The partitions of a number are known, at least in the limit of large numbers of, when large numbers are involved, at least in that case, you get a simple expression. And the answer is just this. If you're counting partitions of a large number like N1 NP, they go exponentially in that number. In fact, they go like exponential of this 2 pi square root of N1 NP over 6. So in fact, we have pretty much counted the entropy which we wanted to do, but now let's be a little bit careful and tie up some loose ends. The string which was vibrating and carrying this momentum up the string, it wasn't just vibrating in one direction. There were in fact 8 different transverse directions of vibration. So in fact, we had to partition the momentum among 8 different flavors, so to say, the vibration in the x1 direction, x2, x3, x4, all the way to x8. So in fact, 8 different kinds of vibrations have to share this N1 NP units of momentum. But further, there are also fermions in the theory because this is a BPS state, and because of SUSY, there are 8 bosonic vibrations. There are also 8 fermionic degrees of freedom. And each fermion counts like half a boson. Anytime you play with conformal field theory, that's probably familiar to you. So they count effectively like 4 more bosons. And so if you work this out, you'll find you have 12 effective bosons to play with. And again, details